thank you very much, Shifa, for that lovely introduction. And I just want to say what a delight it is to be here. I know this place feels, well, it's a certain sort of home to me, this shrine room. It's always had a huge effect. I've had so many experiences here in the shrine room, so it's just wonderful to be back here and looking out at all of you. And yeah, just very happy to be here and sharing my experience. When I thought about what I would like to offer in for this talk, it just was very clear to me that this particular strand of my my entire spiritual life, you could say, my order life particularly, but all the time that I've been practicing, meditation has just been so key for me. It just felt really essential in a way that what I shared was something connected with that. So what I'm going to share, as Shubha said, is my own kind of personal history or personal journey with that set of practices called the Brahma Viharas. And it's not that there's, I'm not doing that because there's anything sort of remarkable about my particular journey with these practices. But somehow sharing my struggles and my understanding as it came and so on, there's a hope that there'll be resonances for people. And also, I just really want to share my love of the Brahma Viharas. These practices have been so important to me. They've had such a transforming effect, I feel, on my life, that it's a wonderful opportunity to share that. So I'm going to take you on this journey, and it is quite a long journey, and it does start in 1974, as Shubha said. I had just happened to hear, I'd been longing to learn to meditate, and I'd happened to hear that the local yoga society had invited someone who was a Buddhist, but I was told it was fine, you didn't have to be a Buddhist, to come and teach them to meditate. And I'd been the week before just in somebody's front room down in Truro in Cornwall, a very informal situation. And we'd done the first week the mindfulness of breathing. And the second week I went along and we were going to do the Metta Bhavana. Lovely that we did that earlier here tonight. And I mean, it's very hard really to convey the impact that this practice had on me back in 1974. And when the order member who was teaching us, his name was Manjivadra, he was talking about the Metta Bhavana practice and talking about explaining this thing that basically the love that one would have, that a mother would have for their child, that we could have that same experience for the whole of humanity, and that's what the Metta Bhavana was aiming at. And I mean, I was just completely flabbergasted, I think. I mean, I was just so blown away by the idea, just the concept of it. I mean, I've never heard anything like it in my life, and it just really fired my imagination. Something about it just went, yes, this is what I really want. I mean, actually, where I was at the time was a million miles from there, but something just said yes in a very strong way. And although that particular practice was not very easy, I was incredibly uncomfortable and so on, somehow, I don't know, beginner's mind, I think I had a very strong case of beginner's mind. I was just transported in a way to another realm. And it felt as though the next period of time, I think about it as being about 3 months, but it might not be as long as that. My life felt completely changed. I felt as though I had seen something through what I'd heard about this practice that just made me open my eyes and look around me and look at people from a completely different perspective to my normal way. It just felt as though just a whole dimension had opened up. Of course, at the time I thought maybe this meditation was really, really powerful stuff, that I was going to be like that for always. But of course, that was not to be. I crashed at some point and found myself very much back to my normal state of mind, which was a long way from there. But nonetheless, it had given me a vision of something, and it had given me an experience of something different that I think really fueled everything that's gone on since. And I feel as though I continue to this day to work to get back to that vision from back then. So, yeah. So once I'd kind of crashed, found myself back to my usual state, I actually found it really, really difficult to do the Metta Bhavana practice. After having had so much sort of inspiration and felt so uplifted by it and so changed by it, then all of a sudden it sort of felt as though the reality hit, and here I was, just me, struggling away trying to do it. And the reality of, you know, I had really said to myself I wanted to do it, you know. I don't think I quite did it on a daily basis then, but I wanted to do it frequently, and was just finding it so difficult, just so difficult. And I was looking for different ways to do the practice, and I tried out all sorts of different things. I got into this way of doing it where I would just sort of get some sort of feeling going and pump it up so that I would end up feeling good after the practice. But then I'd come out and it would be really horrible to find myself so irritable as soon as I was around people again. So I knew that this wasn't the right way to do it, but somehow it just seemed as though that was the only way I could do it at the time. Anyway, I'd been going on like this for quite a way, sort of knowing that there was something wrong with how I was actually doing the practice, that it wasn't the real thing. And at some point, I had an arrangement to go and see Bhante, to come up to London, in fact, and see Bhante. And I had such a strong experience when I came to see him of metta. I just felt to myself at the time, this must be what metta is. It just felt as though I was in sunlight in his company, as though the sun was just, you know, pouring down, and that warmth and wonderful expansive feeling just felt so strong. And it just made me realize that I couldn't continue, after seeing him like that, I couldn't continue to try and approach the Metta Bhavana in the way that I was. I had to, in some way, get more real with it. In those days, we were quite on our own with these sorts of things, and I was living down in Cornwall, didn't have access to... meditation was actually an incredibly new thing, in any case, in those days. You had to very much find your own way. So... I remember going through a phase of just being really determined to try to get to grips with doing the practice. What I think I discovered somewhere around this time, that part of the problem was that I couldn't really be with whatever it was I was experiencing, especially not any of my deeper emotions. Basically, I was quite cut off from them, and I think I was very strongly trying to be the person that I wanted to be, probably fueled a little bit by the vision of what had happened when I first started the practices, rather than actually just being who I was. So that was a very, very good lesson to learn, just to recognize that, particularly with my darker energies, that... you can't just bypass bits of yourself. You know, they have to come with you. You have to try and integrate, refine those energies. So that was quite a strong lesson. But I think also part of it was that I had this idea that metta was something that existed kind of out there, that I wanted to get in here. So I didn't think I had it. It was something that I had to find a way to get. So I think that was another difficulty in preventing me from doing the practice, really. So I think I went on my first solitary retreat somewhere around this time, and decided that on that solitary retreat I was going to focus on the Metta Bhavana practice. And I did that. I know it was quite a struggle, but one of the main things that came very clear to me quite early on was that I actually had a very basic mistrust of people. I actually came to realise that I didn't like people very much. And I don't know if you can imagine how that might feel. I've been so inspired by the idea of metta and so on, but here I'm finding out, you know, that, I mean, I'm sure it wasn't, you know, completely new to me, but it's the first time that I had really faced up to that in myself. Just really recognised that I had created a very strong barrier between myself and people, and that it was through this basic mistrust, but also, you know, there definitely was a feeling of dislike. So I think I saw on that solitary retreat the size of the cloth, as it were, the job that was ahead of me, that I was going to have to kind of turn around in some sort of way. But I think also on that solitary, somewhere in there, I did connect more strongly again with the vision of metta. And a sense that there was something about it that I yearned for, something about it that was very kind of naturally expansive, and I became very aware of the kind of constricted nature of my heart as it was, and just longed for something more open and expansive. So I think I had, on that solitary as well, started to realise that metta wasn't actually out there, that it was within, but the whole thing was that one had to uncover it. And I had remembered that experience of going to see Bhante, and the feeling of just being bathed in sunshine, of metta feeling very much like that. And just became a very strong image for me for metta. And I realised it was a very good image, really, because so much of the time, you know, the sun is obscured by clouds. And that's what I realised was the case with me, that my heart was obscured by the clouds of the places, the poisons. But just in the same way as the sun is, in fact, always there, shining. I mean, it's one of those wonderful things if you go up in an aeroplane, isn't it? You know, and you go through all these layers of cloud, and all of a sudden, there's clear blue sky and sunshine. And I think it really helped having that kind of vision of what metta really was, that it was there all the time, shining. It was just completely obscured by the clouds of my own conditioning and my own views. The poisons, the places. And that the job was actually to clear away those clouds. It gave me a feeling of something a bit more tangible, thinking of it in that way. And I recognised that, you know, yeah, the seeds are there in the soil of my being, and it's just up to me to create the conditions, you know, that kind of really allow them to grow and flourish. On that solitary, I made the decision when I came home that I was going to really continue to focus on the Metta Bhavana practice, but I was going to particularly focus on Metta in the neutral zone, that stage in the Metta Bhavana practice that's very difficult to do, really, and I really wanted to pay it more attention as a way of trying to redress this imbalance, my mistrust of people, to see if I could find a way to actually move towards people a little bit more. Doing that, actually focusing on metta in the neutral zone, and it, one of the main things about it was just that it was quite shocking to realise how strongly ingrained the habit was of, kind of, in a way, just blanking people out. That was the way that I did it. It was, I suppose, I was in a kind of protective shell, and I just didn't kind of see people particularly. So trying to do this metta in the neutral zone meant that off my cushion as well as on the cushion, I was really trying to recognize when I was doing that. I was trying to see what the triggers were that kind of closed me off, and I was just really trying to take people in more, you know, if I was standing in a supermarket queue or whatever it was that I was doing, instead of, you know, just getting myself in my own little world, I was very much trying to, you know, kind of open myself up to the people around me and, yeah, just, you know, trying to feel some sort of human connection with people. So it was hard, but it definitely did feel like, through that kind of perseverance, through that kind of practice, I started to make some small dents in that particular habit. It's amazing, really, how strong some of these habits can be. I don't know if any of you are finding that out, but it's, over time. I suppose one's so identified with these things, they sort of feel like, well, that's who you are, that is you, and that's how it felt at the time. So it was a big thing, really, trying to kind of break through it. Somewhere around this time, I got introduced to the full set of the Brahma Vihara practices, the all four practices. If I'm talking about things that you know you're not familiar with, hopefully if you're interested, you will find somebody at some point just to ask more about them. When I heard about all four practices, I was just really, really inspired by the vision that they presented. It just seemed completely amazing. I mean, on the one hand, it did seem completely natural, but on the other hand, it was so at odds with how the world that I lived in, you know, how people behaved towards each other and so on. It just seemed, so completely extraordinary. Whilst at the same time having this sort of feeling that somehow it was completely natural as well. I was very awed by them, I remember that, quite daunted by the prospect, but I knew even then somehow that these practices were important to me and that I was going to, come what may, I was going to try to get to know them more. I got ordained in 83 and things changed quite a bit then after ordination. I had a bumpy couple of first years in the order, but I think it immediately gave me a greater confidence that I really could change. I think that was very important, somehow just sort of recognizing that I really could change. Having a sadhana practice and a name that valued a part of me that I hadn't valued at all made a huge difference. And besides doing the sadhana practice, I continued to focus on metta and to do the other Brahma Viharas when I could. About 3 years after I was ordained, I went on a 3-month solitary retreat. You're probably gathering that solitary retreats were something that I did quite frequently. I did in fact go on a solitary every year, mostly for a month, but this one was a 3-month solitary, which felt like a great opportunity. And it was a real turning point. On that solitary, I think I really did go deeper in myself and my practice and understood things in a way I hadn't quite understood before. And I think that one of the key things was that I'd really learned on that solitary to sit with myself and to listen to myself. It was as though I befriended myself on that solitary. I started actually to be interested in a way in some of the quieter voices within me rather than the usual rather loud storylines that sort of played out all the time. It's as though I started to listen to something deeper within me, and started to open up to that and trust it in a way that I hadn't quite before. And through that, it felt as though I was just more able to be with myself in all my many hues, all my different shades, my darker sides as well as the lighter sides. So it was very, very important. I did the Brahmaviharas a lot on that 3 month solitary. I do remember a lot of struggle, practice after practice, stage after stage, resistance, a lot of resistance. I remember feeling a bit like treacle at times, wading through them. But I don't know, there was something about it that just felt okay, in spite of the fact that it didn't feel like I was kind of getting anywhere very much. That was all right. It felt quite real. I suppose I was much more able to kind of, you know, be with whatever was there in my experience. And that just made, well, whatever was happening was happening. It felt quite different. Although the struggle was there, it felt like the sort of, I don't know, the inspiration to keep going was stronger. Yeah, I definitely felt on that solitary that my resolve that this was how I wanted to manifest in the world, that I really wanted to manifest through the Brahmaviharas, to manifest through me and my interactions in the world, that became really strong. And I know that I felt then very clear that my intention, my heart wish in a sense, for this to be the case, that was the most important thing. And that whatever may or may not happen while I was actually on the cushion trying to do the practice, it wasn't that it didn't matter, but the important thing was that I was really sort of cultivating this wish, this heart wish, to manifest then through me in the world. So, going on from there, my experience of doing the actual Brahmavihara practices was still very out of balance. I got on fine in a way, well, you know, to varying degrees with metta, and got on very well in a sense with karuna, but upekka, the upekka bhavana, and mudita bhavana, upekka being equanimity and mudita being sympathetic joy, they still felt like rather distant peaks, something to be explored at some point. I think I came to realize at some point that actually I was very identified with karuna. That's why I got on so well with karuna bhavana. I came to see that actually part of my identification was with myself as a suffering person. It felt like a very natural kind of connection with that practice because, you know, it was about suffering, and if I'm a suffering person, then the two sort of go together. And I think at the time I thought that that was quite a good thing, you know, that I was good at one of them anyway. But it took me quite a long time to realise that, in fact, I was over-focused, over-identified with that particular practice, over-identified with suffering, and that it was acting as a barrier. It was blocking me off, well, from mudita and upekka, from the sympathetic joy and the equanimity. But it also was preventing me from having a more authentic experience of my own suffering and indeed of others' suffering. You know, it was just very clear after a while that, you know, because of that over-focus, I just wasn't even able to see myself very clearly. So, yeah, it also came very clear that I couldn't relate very strongly to the positive in myself because of that, because I was just very fixed on one aspect of my experience, but it also meant that I found it difficult to see the positive in other people. I related very strongly if they were suffering in some way, but yeah, so I realised something had to change as far as that was concerned. So it was more layers to unpeel. And it was very painful, very, very painful, unravelling all that, having to really face that in myself and see again how my own patterns, in a sense, had been, obscuring me from myself, and recognising that, of course, this is what happens when we get very strongly identified with particular views. And of course, at the root, I discovered, through all that unravelling, fear was really at the root of a lot of it. And it was a fear about what would happen if I no longer continued to protect the kind of illusory me, this illusory sense of me. So I knew that something had to change. So out of it came a very important decision. A decision that, I didn't realise at the time how important it was going to be, but it definitely turned out to be an important decision. I made the decision that I was going to deliberately work on mudita, on the mudita bhavana, for a period of time, again to try to kind of redress this balance. I remember that being really tough going again. It was quite a lot. It was tough going on this journey. The whole idea of mudita was just completely alien to me. I mean, it's amazing to say this. I was ordained and, I understood it on a certain level. But, when I really came down to it, I realised how much it kind of went against the grain. I suppose that, I had this very strong identity with suffering. But I just hadn't been able to, see the other side of the coin. So I found, rejoicing very difficult, rejoicing in other people. I found it excruciating to be rejoiced in. So it was just very, very hard. But I knew somehow that I was on the right track, that I had to persevere and keep going. And, it wasn't as though there weren't, there were some moments of real, real joy in there as well during this time of focusing on mudita. It wasn't just all difficulty. I can remember some times when I would just suddenly have that sort of sense of real resonance with another person, with their happiness or their good fortune or whatever. A real gladness in my heart, and I think those gave me glimpses of what it could be like to let mudita into my heart more, and in particular, what it might be like not to judge, not to compare, not to feel envy, and that was such a spur, just to really keep going. Just the thought, just the experience, that little glimpse of what that might be like. So over time, it did really open up a whole new dimension. And it had the effect over quite a long period of time as well of slowly kind of prizing me away from this very strong view of myself as a suffering person. Mudita, it has an amazing transformative power. It's just so naturally expansive. It's there was a lovely occasion here in this shrine room, actually. There's an order member called Ratnaketu, New Zealand young guy from, well, he's not so young now, I don't suppose, but then he was quite young. And he was giving a talk about mudita, and he was likening it to a golden ball. And I remember him somewhere around here giving the talk and saying how mudita is as though you yourself, you have this very small golden ball and you throw it to somebody and they catch it, and the ball gets that little bit larger, and they throw it to somebody else and it gets a bit larger, and mudita just has this natural expansion. It ends up this huge golden ball, and everybody is somehow affected by it. And I've really had an experience, or many experiences now, of mudita being like that. It is just truly wonderful, the way it just opens you up, it expands. Yeah, it's a truly sort of, it's very, very connected. I think that's one of the things about it, it's very connected. And yeah, I think previously I had thought that a kind of very disconnected exhilaration that I used to get into sometimes, I used to think that was mudita. So it was quite something to discover it, that it's a very rooted kind of joy, a very connected kind of joy, that it doesn't lose sight of the other side of the coin either, somehow. It doesn't lose sight of suffering. So I think taking mudita on in this way really brought home to me that the Brahma Viharas were now an essential path of practice for me. I was experiencing for myself something of their transformative power and beauty, and glimpsing something about them that felt very whole, very complete. So I went on another solitary. One of the things about these solitaries was that they were sort of like a real touchstone. Going on a solitary every year, I would really get a strong sense of where I was at that particular time. And I would always end the solitary kind of knowing where it was I needed to be heading. So immensely valuable times. I really love my solitary retreats. On this one, my intention was to, I had just started doing a different sadhana practice to the one I'd taken on when I was ordained. I was doing the four-armed Avalokiteshvara sadhana then, and I had then taken on the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara practice. And yes, I really wanted to focus on this particular practice on my solitary. And one of the things that I had been really loving about it in the few months I'd been doing it before I went on solitary was that it very strongly involved the five Buddha mandala. I just really loved the sense that somehow one felt almost like you were living in that mandala doing the practice. It was a very, very strong feeling. So I was looking forward very much on the solitary retreat to having a longer, more intense experience of that. And it was extraordinary how alive the mandala of the five Buddhas came on this particular solitary retreat. It just seemed as though whatever was happening, whatever mental states or emotional states I was getting into, somehow or other the appropriate Buddha from that mandala would just somehow, manifest in a way that just showed me so clearly my delusion most of the time. It was just wonderful to feel such a kind of alive connection somehow on this solitary. Their wisdoms just seemed so totally relevant, and there was something about them being manifestations of absolute purity, of the poisons completely purified, the elements completely purified. And I think something in me just really yearned for that, and on the solitary it just felt so beautiful to be able to be living in this mandala in the way that I felt I was. I'd already been relating very strongly to the Brahma Viharas as a means of transforming the poisons. So on this retreat, there was a wonderful coming together of the two mandalas, the mandala of the five Buddhas and the mandala of the Brahma Viharas. It just felt wonderful to, somehow with each Brahma Vihara relating, the poison that Brahma Vihara transformed with one of the Buddhas from the mandala, because they also transform the same poison. So just this sense of those two things coming together in that way on that solitary retreat, it was just like this magical shift somehow in energy away from the kind of sense of everything being such a struggle, you know, struggling to do stage after stage, to suddenly a deeper engagement. It was just quite magical, that sense that something really happened. There, a real shift did take place, and it came about through the kind of these two mandalas suddenly kind of coming together and making absolute sense, and having that kind of representation, you know, that is there through the mandala of the five Buddhas. It just made everything seem possible somehow, in a way that it just hadn't before. So I knew something deeply significant had happened, but I didn't quite know what that was, but I knew in time it would reveal itself. One of the things I felt very strongly was that I was no longer backing away from samsara, which is how I usually experienced myself, but I felt as though I had been turned around and I was now actually facing the transcendental. It was a very pivotal moment on that solitary retreat, very significant. I somehow knew, I mean, Avalokiteshvara, that was the sadhana practice that I was doing, that took place in the context of this five Buddha mandala. I knew that somehow through him, I was on this path of practice that would continue for the rest of my life and beyond. And since then, there has been a real sea change in my faith that I could truly manifest these very beautiful states of heart and mind to ever-increasing degrees, that it was possible to go beyond all these strong habits and ingrained tendencies that I've been working with over all this time. I think I really believed more than I ever had before that I could gain enlightenment on that solitary retreat in the distant future, of course, but the possibility that one could do it. So I think it had also become very clear to me as well that these very beautiful, radiantly beautiful states of heart and mind, the Brahma-Viharas, that, you know, whilst they are innate within us, they don't in any way belong to us. They are kind of, beyond that. They're both kind of within and without. We're a channel through which they can manifest. So my experience of practicing them after this felt quite different. They were now much more like facets of a whole rather than individual sort of separate practices as I had seen them before. They were really truly a mandala of practices. And there was just that lovely sense that I could work much more from where I was and trust that whatever I needed would arise. But it would become clear, working with this mandala, with the mandala of the Brahma-Viharas and the mandala of the five Buddhas, whatever, in a sense, whatever I needed would become clear, and I would know that I could trust that that would happen, and I'd find a way forward from there. After that solitary, I remember I did focus very particularly, because I'd realized on the solitary this was what I needed to do, on the near enemies of the practices. Those of you who are more familiar with the Brahma-Viharas will know that there's we can experience something that feels as though it is the real thing, but actually it isn't. It's a more conditioned, a more attached sort of state of mind that looks like you think it's metta, but it isn't quite metta, or you think it's compassion, but it isn't quite compassion. And previously, I'd hated it whenever I found myself getting into one of these, recognizing that, you know, I was getting into one of these near enemies. But after that solitary, I seemed to really welcome it. It just felt really important to just be able to acknowledge where I was and what was actually happening in the practice. If I didn't know where I was, how was I going to change it? How could I make a choice about what I was going to do, how I was going to continue? So focusing on those near enemies was a fascinating time, absolutely fascinating time. Really discovering, you know, all the sneaky ways, and sometimes not so sneaky ways, that my energy would just be kind of appropriating these states. It was just fascinating, blocking the flow in the practice. So I just became quite fascinated, I think, by just sort of seeing how devious one could be, and you know, just the way the mind and heart can work, and just felt very open to exploring that more, just in a very kind of honest way, which was such a change from going back to how things were in the beginning. And the mandala just felt very alive, very engaging. However, there was another of those kind of crunch points that had been there all along, and it was when I came to realise I was still holding equanimity at bay. I think I still felt equanimity was sort of beyond me in some way. In fact, you know, when I'd heard about all the Brahma Viharas, it was the one that attracted me the most. There was something it spoke about that just really moved me so deeply. But at the same time, I think it terrified me. I was just really completely in awe of it. And, yeah, I had been always a person of extremes, and like some of my other habits and tendencies, I think I quite liked my extremes. I certainly liked my highs, and I probably didn't like the lows so much, but they seemed part of the price I had to pay. And I had this idea somehow that equanimity meant that, you know, everything was just going to get sort of squashed down into this kind of evened out. It meant evenness, equanimity. I was going to have to lose those highs and lose the lows, take all the kind of colour, it felt like, out of my practice. I mean, it's amazing how one can still harbour these sorts of ideas. I remember thinking it's one's inner landscape. It's a bit like, you'd be living in Norfolk when you'd been previously living in Wales. I live in Wales at the moment, all the beautiful hills and everything. Norfolk's all a bit flat and boring. Sorry, Norfolk. So anyway, I'd resisted. I had just really resisted looking at all this. I'd really resisted kind of facing up to it. And the time had come when I was ready to do it. And of course, you know, the first thing that became very clear was that, you know, my highs and my lows actually were states of alienation. They weren't anything really that I wanted to hold on to. I recognised that I completely lost perspective when I was at the peak of either of them, when I was up high or when I was down low. And of course, what Upeka spoke about was something just completely different. You know, equanimity is deeply, deeply connected. You know, it understands the way things are, and it sees that things arise in dependence on conditions, and change dependent on conditions. Everything has its arising and its passing away. So it has that perspective, but it has the understanding. You know, it sees the whole picture. It has a wisdom eye. It's wonderful. Because of having that perspective, it doesn't react. And because it doesn't react, it just brings about this sort of sense of a very profound positivity. It's metta come to fruition. Just the realization of that's really what equanimity is, metta come to fruition. But I could see that all of those things were what I feared about equanimity, because it would mean I'd have to change again. I'd have to let go of, you know, more ideas about, you know, kind of who I was and, yeah, just change. I think I had also feared that, you know, equanimity was in some way some sort of lukewarm indifference. And I just hated the idea of that. How I could ever have thought that is beyond me now, but I did. But of course, that, in a sense, that's the way in which we can kind of distance ourselves from things and kind of keep us from really seeing the truth. That's what I recognise for myself anyway. I mean, it, you know, realizing that, you know, it is the culmination of the Brahma Viharas, that it actually contains them all. How could there be anything, you know, kind of lukewarm or wishy-washy about that? I mean, it's a composite emotion derived from the fundamental Brahma Vihara, which is metta, mantled, as Bhante says so beautifully, with the sober shades of Karuna, and clothed in the bright dancing colours of mudita. It has this immovable quality as well, this wonderful sense of balance that prevents us from falling into extremes, so you're no longer tossed about by the worldly winds. But it isn't anything static either. It has this truly dynamic quality. I came across a wonderful quote that I'm going to read you now from Bhante in a seminar transcript about equanimity. I first heard it years ago, and it thrilled me, I think, because what it speaks of is something so, well, profound. I'll read it to you and see what you think. So he says, it's on account of equanimity in its ultimate sense that you're balanced, even with regard to samsara and nirvana. Even those two extremes don't disturb you. Subject and object are the same or not different, so far as you're concerned. You're in a state of absolute equanimity. Or, as I have said elsewhere, you're in a state of axiality and centrality. You have reached what the Chinese mystics call the unwobbling pivot of existence. As the Mangala Sutta says, you are the one whose mind does not shake when touched by the eight Lokadharmas. He goes on to say, do you know what I mean by axiality? You feel as though you are the axis upon which everything turns, though not in an egoistic sense. You are absolutely stable and unshakable, immovable, though at the same time you're extremely mobile, even dancing all over the place. You don't need to have your centre fixed in any particular spot. Your centre is everywhere. So I just found that so inspiring, that sense of you know, you don't need to have your centre fixed in any particular spot. Your centre is everywhere. Wonderful. So, one of my overriding experiences over time was how completely natural the whole cycle of the Brahma Viharas is. They're just wonderful. If you're in trouble with one of them, you look to one of the other ones to get you out of that trouble. They're so sort of complete within themselves. I mean, if you sit with metta and the alchemy that happens when it meets suffering or joy, how it changes, how it just very naturally changes. And doing this again and again, you know, I find it just seems to sort of wear away one's edges. It wears away your kind of resistance to really facing the truth, to really seeing things as they are. You know, you're just letting that metta, you know, come into contact with suffering, come into contact with joy. Just that oscillation between the suffering and the joy over and over. Something happens, and what happens in a way, that they're like the gateways that just open the door to equanimity. It's just, they're just amazing practices, and Karuna and Mudita just really help free us from our attachment and our aversion, finding that sort of middle way between them. And the natural outcome of that is equanimity. I find they demand a very kind of alive, engaged awareness of heart and mind if you're really going to cultivate them. Prior to taking this on more fully, I think I used to get lost in them emotionally, but one of the things, I'm just much more of an emotional bent than an intellectual sort of bent. But what these practices have taught me, and it's been such an important lesson to learn, is that one really does have to bring reason to bear on the emotions if they are to become fully integrated, if they are to become more refined. They need to be given shape and form by our reason. It's just crucial for them to be fully effective. And that's been a really, really important lesson for me to learn, you know, not to just sort of go letting the emotions sort of run all over the place, but really bringing my mind to bear on it. And through that, you know, sort of really, really finding a way to give them shape, give them form, and let them therefore be so much more effective. So once you truly believe that they are our spiritual birthright, which is what the Dalai Lama calls them, how can you fly in the face of reality and continue as you are? This is what I ask myself over and over. How can you not be drawn to recognize and clear away all that obscures them so that they can manifest? And it just seems, you know, again and again and again, I have to continually say this to myself. How can I not be drawn to just wanting to clear away all the obscurations and just let them shine forth more and more? So in our system of practice, the Brahma Viharas, to my mind, fill so much more than just the role of helping us cultivate positive emotion. You know, they really do help us do that. They do help us become much more happy, healthy and human. But they're also so much more than that. They really are practices of total transformation. I think they're a path to insight, a path to the bodhicitta. They're a way of life that just isn't dependent on the way the pendulum swings. Through them we can find a response appropriate to any situation that we would find ourselves in. Bhante says in Living with Kindness that metta is the norm or measure of our human response to others. It's the template or pattern. And the same is true for all the Brahma Viharas. I mean, just how wonderful is that, you know, that it's the norm, the template. I think that is just so wonderful. The very nature of consciousness itself is a wellspring of loving kindness, is how Alan Wallace expresses it in his book Boundless Heart. So they are the norm, the template, completely natural and awesomely beautiful. Together they're very whole and complete. They're said to be the healthiest states of mind possible this side of enlightenment. And I yearn to manifest them more and more fully. I'm going to just finish by letting you hear Bhante talk about the culmination of them, metta come to fruition. Just read a little bit about equanimity and leave you with that. Upekkha, equanimity, is a spiritual quality of a particularly elevated kind. There are traces of it in ordinary experience, perhaps in the tranquility that can be found in nature, in the experience of standing alone in a forest when the air is still and the trees stand silently around you. But Upeka goes far beyond even that kind of stillness. It has an intense, definite, even dynamic character of its own. And that is only to describe Upeka in its mundane sense. The fully developed Brahma-Vihara is peacefulness of an indescribably subtle and intense kind. Infused as it is by insight, it is as though there is nothing but that peace. It is truly universal and utterly immovable. It is not just an absence of conflict. It has a magnitude and a solidity all of its own. Since it partakes of the nature of reality itself, no kind of disturbance can affect it in any way.